Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Dr. Bruce Sands, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity titled, How Low Can You Go? Targeting of Deep Remission in the Management of Crohn's Disease. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Lilly. So today's activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, which is an award-winning, jointly accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians worldwide. I also want to encourage everyone to join us today on our live Twitter conversation at CME Outfitters. We'll be monitoring the Twitter feed and responding to your tweets as they come in. Also, I want to remind our audience that the iPads and the online platform you are using today allows you to save slides, take notes on slides, answer polling questions, and send us your questions, so please log in and interact with us. You will also receive a copy of all the slides if you log in, so I encourage you to log in, do exactly that. I'm Bruce Sands. As I mentioned before, I'm the Dr. Burrell B. Crohn Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Gastroenterology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. And I'm delighted to be joined this morning by two distinguished colleagues who I'll ask to introduce themselves, starting with Dr. Long.
Hi, I'm Millie Long. I'm Professor of Medicine at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Thank you, Millie. Thanks for joining us. And Marita.
Hi, my name is Marita Comedis. I'm a nurse practitioner and ostomy specialist practicing out of University of Chicago.
Great. And let's start by going over our learning objectives for today. Our first learning objective is to integrate knowledge of the heterogeneity of Crohn's disease and severity and manifestation into patient assessment and treatment. Our second learning objective is to utilize alternative diagnostic and evaluation tools beyond colonoscopy for evaluating symptoms in patients with Crohn's disease. And our third is to incorporate histopathologic treatment targets as an objective measure of inflammation in Crohn's disease to inform clinical decision making. So we have a lot to talk about here this morning, and I'm going to start by turning it over to Marita, who's going to talk about disease heterogeneity in Crohn's. Marita.
Thank you. So when we meet a patient with Crohn's disease and are thinking about their management, it's imperative that we're looking at risk stratification when we're thinking about the management of our patients. So we need to be thinking about those things that make our patients at high risk for progression to severe disease. So those are patients that are diagnosed at an early age, patients with extensive anatomic involvement, patients with perianal disease, severe rectal disease, deep knife-like ulcers on endoscopy, patients that have a history of prior surgical resections or surgical therapy, stricturing and penetrating behavior. And we communicate some of that risk through the Montreal classification. So we look at the age at which patients were diagnosed, as well as the location of disease and the behavior of that disease. In Crohn's disease management, it's important that we're always staying on our toes and assessing our patients comprehensively. We see here that there are patients that will demonstrate a change in disease behavior throughout their disease course, and may even change their disease location or anatomic extent throughout their duration of disease. When we look at patients with Crohn's disease, we have to think about activity versus severity. So we have patients that will come into the office and they'll be talking about their activity, so their current inflammatory burden, how they're feeling, their symptoms that have brought them into the office today, and we can use that in combination with our most recent objective inflammatory markers to really assess the current activity for our patients. Certainly, we should also be thinking in terms of severity. Severity is kind of what brought us to today. So historical disease behavior, need for surgery in the past, patients with extensive anatomic bowel involvement, as well as patients that have experienced complications as a result of their Crohn's disease. So as I had mentioned, patients that come in will tell us about their activity of disease, but we have to think about what brought them to today throughout their disease diagnosis and experience. So we think about patients at their age of diagnosis, the disease location that's been affected, and the implications based upon that. Some of the disease behavior, whether this is a patient that has had stricturing disease or a patient that's had penetrative disease. Patients that have concomitant inflammatory disorders like psoriasis or spondyloarthropathies. patients that have had a vast previous treatment exposure and what those responses have been. Patients with extraintestinal manifestations, those can often give us a clue into a mechanism of action that may be most beneficial for our patients. Patients that have required past surgeries and how that past surgery has changed their anatomical involvement and how that's impacting their symptoms today. Looking at history of nutritional deficiencies and ensuring that we're monitoring for those even in a period of wellness or disease quiescence. And then looking as well, as I mentioned, as historical disease behavior versus behavior of today. So when we look at some of the extraintestinal manifestations in Crohn's disease, it can be a bit unpredictable. So we see that extraintestinal manifestations will impact at least half of patients with IBD, and a quarter of patients will even develop an extraintestinal manifestation prior to their diagnosis of IBD. So it's important to be doing that comprehensive assessment when talking with patients about not just luminal symptoms in disease, but also talking about those arthropathies and skin problems, eye issues, things like that. And it's important as well to identify that we do have certain extraintestinal manifestations that can be dependent on luminal disease, but also some inflammatory processes that are independent of luminal inflammation. It's also important that we identify the difference between extraintestinal manifestations of IBD, which are inflammatory pathologies outside of the gut, as well as extraintestinal complications of IBD, so sequela of intestinal inflammation that's impacting our patients. When we look at the way that we're treating our patients and how we're measuring efficacy, we think of the treat-to-target approach. So I describe this to patients in clinic as, you know, my first objective is that you're feeling better. My second objective is that we're normalizing inflammatory markers, fecal calprotectin, CRP if they make it. And then my third objective is that you're showing endoscopic or radiographic healing. But we can take this even a step further into disease modification and look at not only are all of our markers and our charting systems looking normal, but that we're having patients return to a period of lack of disability. They're having an improved quality of life. They're not having a need for surgery. They're not having a need for hospital admission. And so by doing this, we're preventing disease complication and we're reducing long-term complications for our patients. So when we think of Crohn's disease, we know that this is a mucosal and transmural process. So we think about what are the benefits and outcomes associated with the healing, not just mucosally, but also transmurally. We see lower rates of steroid utilization. We see lower rates of hospitalization and admission for our patients. Decreased rates of relapse and need for treatment escalation, as well as decreased rates for surgical intervention required for these patients. So how do we evaluate the treat-to-target approach? As I mentioned, you know, we're looking at patients feeling better, we're normalizing those objective measures, and then we're looking at endoscopic and radiographic healing. So we start off with our baseline assessments and our initiation of a new therapy. So we've got our benchmark of where the patient is today. And then we're looking at our short-term goals, which is the early response to treatment. So our patients are starting to feel better. They're starting to return back to the things outside of Crohn's disease in their life that they enjoy to do. And we're also looking at CRP and fecal calprotectin, as well as intestinal ultrasound, which Dr. Long will review further coming up. We're then looking at some of our intermediate goals. So we're trying to keep our patient in that clinical remission, as well as enhancing our response with CRP and fecal calprotectin. And our long-term assessments include endoscopic healing and radiographic healing as well. And if at any point we're not meeting these goals, we're optimizing therapy or we're switching therapy to ensure that we're kind of restarting this set of treat-to-target approaches. When we think about some of the consequences of recurrent inflammatory activity, we think about a patient who starts a diagnosis with some level of inflammation, and we try to get them under control, but may have subsequent flares that result in structural damage, fistulizing, stricturing disease, as well as bowel dysfunction that can often lead to compromised nutritional status and malabsorption, and eventually with undercontrolled or uncontrolled disease, leading potentially to the development of dysplasia or perforation requiring surgical intervention. So we see here that Colin Bell and colleagues did a great job really depicting this for us, that there's an early opportunity for intervention for our patients with Crohn's disease. So we see that the natural course of Crohn's disease is this kind of relapsing and remitting, nonlinear process, but that we're all heading in the same direction of inflammatory increased burden and damage. And so we see that in early diagnosis, this is our window to intervene and to potentially modify disease. And so this is why early diagnosis is really imperative. And we see that there's a benefit for effective treatment and intervention early in disease with tight monitoring and control to keep patients in a state of disease quiescence and potentially prevent some of these sequelae that can happen. So when we look at some of the ways that we think about treating our patients with Crohn's disease, we think of a top-down approach or a step-up approach. And so this slide is a great depiction of that. So we see patients at week zero with Crohn's disease who started on infliximab and an immunomodulator. And those patients were brought into remission on that regimen. And if patients flared, they were able to have an additional course of steroids. And throughout this process, subsequent flares resulted in either a non-response or treatment withdrawal. But we see that the accelerated step-up program is patients that completed a steroid wean, and if they subsequently flared, were started on an immunomodulator. And if they flared despite the immunomodulator, were then started on infliximab plus an immunomodulator. So essentially, you have patients that are 32 weeks after the patients from the top-down approach starting an effective therapy. So when we look at the primary endpoints for this study, the primary endpoint was sustained surgery-free and steroid-free remission at week 48. And we see that the top-down approach was able to reach that in 79% of patients, so a much greater portion than patients in the step-up approach. And we see that patients in endoscopic remission, again, we've got these patients in the top-down approach that are having a greater response. So really the imperative of this slide is that requiring failure of conventional therapy isn't required to advance on to advanced therapy, and that we should be treating patients with the right medication class at the right time for early disease control. We see here a list of studies as well that really hone in on the early biologic therapy benefits for decreasing the risk of surgery and Crohn's disease. And we know that patients that have gone through surgery and Crohn's disease, it can often be a somewhat traumatizing experience and something that really informs their attitudes towards their disease going forward. So important that we're intervening appropriately. So in summary, disease severity considers not just the patient that's in front of you today, but what brought them to you and what they've experienced thus far in their disease course, as well as the benefits of tight control that can prevent complications in Crohn's disease, as well as early advanced therapy, which is appropriate and does not necessarily require failure of conventional step therapy.
Beautiful. Marita, thank you so much. And we have time for a little bit of discussion, and there are some questions coming in. Again, I encourage you to submit your questions. And what I want to talk about is sort of practice guidelines and clinical practice guidelines. I mean, do we use these, and do they really meet our needs? Are there areas where they don't actually address? So I think the first question is, do you use guidelines, and to what extent, Marita?
Certainly. I think we have to have a basis for our practice that's evidence-based. And certainly looking as well as, the patient-centered approach of looking at utilizing those guidelines and translating them to the patient in front of you and making sure that we are, intervening at an appropriate level early on in the disease course.
Yeah, I think importantly, payers certainly pay attention to guidelines. And so what goes into a guideline can be very influential in ways that don't include you and the patient necessarily. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand them. But they don't address every situation that we see. And I guess I could start by asking about some of the things that we experience in Crohn's disease. For example, mild Crohn's disease is a big kind of open area. Millie, I mean, how do we think about this and
what
the guidelines guide us about with that or not?
And I think that this is a plug, the American College of Gastroenterology guidelines for both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis have been updated. They're currently under review and will be out early next year in the Red Journal. And I will say both of those sets of guidelines have tried to go beyond from prior guidelines to help us in some of these uncertain areas. You know, one example of the guidelines being useful is, as Marita was talking about, the role of calprotectin, which at first was not covered by insurers here in the U.S., and really as the evidence became more overwhelming that this is a great way to monitor from a tight control perspective, it really now is covered, and I think hopefully is now a part of your practice as well as much more a part of mine. You know, to specifically answer your question, Bruce, I think mild Crohn's is difficult. And the reason it's difficult is not because the patients do poorly. Those with truly mild Crohn's don't necessarily need a maintenance agent. In many instances, with dietary modifications and monitoring, someone may not need a therapy. The hard part is figuring out who has mild Crohn's and who will progress. We just don't have good predictive biomarkers from that perspective. And so I think, as Marita showed us in the profile study, what becomes really important is understanding the patient in front of you, monitoring them carefully if you do feel that they have mild Crohn's, such that you can pivot quickly to start an advanced therapy. I think that you know, about 20% of patients will have this mild form of Crohn's disease. They may have a few aphthous ulcers in the terminal ileum, be relatively asymptomatic. But 80% will have progressive disease. So we need to be able to identify who is in that 80% to be able to intervene earlier to prevent these downstream complications.
Yeah, I think the tough distinction is, Marita, you talked about severity versus activity. And when a patient is first diagnosed, you don't really know about the severity because you don't have the long experience for that particular patient. You have your intuition, but we don't have fantastic markers of who's going to be progressive. But there probably are some situations where we do get more worried about a patient, and you mentioned some of them. Can you highlight the things that you look for?
Yes, certainly. So patients that present at diagnosis with stricturing or penetrative behavior are patients that I'm very worried about progressive prognosis in, as well as patients that have an early age of diagnosis or extensive anatomical involvement, because we want to be really mindful of the progressive damage that can occur to those structures, because we know that it will have nutritional complications down the road and potentially lead to the need for surgical intervention.
I agree.
And I would argue that anyone with deeper ulcers endoscopically, by definition, is no longer a mild patient. And so I do think we have to, I would encourage you to think about using some standardized endoscopic scores in practice, because the SESCD can help you in terms of the area of involvement of the ulceration in a segment, and the idea that that those deep serpiginous ulcers, those are the ones I worry about. The few aphtha on the surface are a very different phenomenon.
That's right. It's interesting that we don't have good ways of quantifying the depth of ulcers,
right,
but it does seem to be very important and speaks to the transmural nature,
right,
of Crohn's disease. I guess other types of patients I worry about are younger patients. They're going,
right,
to have a long time in their life with the disease, and patients with very extensive disease, especially very extensive small bowel disease,
I agree.
Do worry about from the get-go.
By definition, if someone has upper tract involvement above the ligament of Treitz, that is a patient with a much more progressive phenotype, and that is someone definitively I would put on advanced therapy, as Marita showed us based on the profile study, to try to help to modify that disease over time. That has been one phenotype that I have found to be very difficult to control.
I agree. There are some questions coming in. One is, maybe, Mill, you mentioned using endoscopic indices in practice, so how do you use the SESCD in practice? What is it? What are the components, and how do you use it?
So exactly. So I use it as a yardstick. It helps to have something objective. You can communicate with the patient and understand where the area of involvement is. You know, it's obviously you can't just use the total score, because if you have isolated ileal involvement, your SESCD is going to be lower generally. But by comparing segment to segment, you can really try to understand if your patient is improving objectively from an endoscopic perspective. I think it's important to realize that while, of course, our goal is endoscopic remission, remember that endoscopic response is still a really good outcome. And if someone improves from deep ulcers to a few aphtha, that's success, and you'll be able to measure that based on the SESCD. In ulcerative colitis, which we're not speaking about, the Mayo score can be very helpful in that same fashion in terms of that yardstick for improvement.
And most endoscopic reporting systems now incorporate a module where it's very easy to click off. So I think all of us can learn how to do this, the Mayo score, and you see obviously is quite simple,
right.
And we all do that. There are other questions here, and maybe this one is for you, Marita. And someone is asking, are fecal calprotectin and CRP good markers of inflammation in Crohn's disease?
Yes. So my first objective when looking at patients is, do they make CRP? We know that 20% of our patients, often won't make CRP. So really benchmarking a fecal calprotectin during periods of both disease quiescence as well as disease activity is important. I often request that patients will complete a calprotectin the same day as colonoscopy, so I'm able to really benchmark for that patient really the volume of calprotectin that they produce. But it's a great non-invasive way to be able to get a benchmark of where our patients are. I often will do it 4 weeks after starting a new therapy as a non-invasive diagnostic to make sure that we're heading in the right direction.
I will say that I think many of you in the audience recognize that it may be a little bit more reliable in the colon, and I think it correlates much better in ulcerative colitis. But that said, it can still be a valid and reliable test in Crohn's disease. You know, one area where I have found it to be more reliable is postoperative recurrence.
Yes, for sure.
And, you know, I don't know if that has something to do with removal of the ileocecal valve, and, you know, the sensitivity and specificity is much better in that state. So if you have a postoperative patient with Crohn's disease, a CalPro over 100 correlates pretty well with endoscopic recurrence, and so that's something that I would encourage you to utilize. It's now readily available and easy to use in practice. Other than that, I think the benchmarking becomes important. If they have colonic involvement, it's very reliable. If someone has isolated ileal involvement, you just want to make sure you've benchmarked and understand what it is at a time period of increased inflammation. In many instances in my practice, I've found it to be elevated, but it's not elevated to the same extent as colonic disease when they do have active ileal inflammation. I don't know if you found the same, Bruce.
Yeah, very much so. And I think patients are relatively true to themselves, so you get to learn their patterns by following over time.
Right.
Of course, persuading a patient to do repeated fecal calprotectin is not always that easy.
Yeah, no, they have to buy into the process, for
That's
sure.
That's for yeah. sure. I think, actually, this discussion, this question is a perfect segue into your talk, Millie, which is about monitoring beyond endoscopy, and you're going to talk about the non-invasive monitoring tools that we have. So I'll hand it to you.
Great. Yes, of course. And so I agree. Great segue. CalPro is one of the things we'll be discussing. And I also hope to show you a novel method that has increased utilization here in the U.S., endoscopic ultrasound. And certainly we'll talk about some radiologic assessments as well. You know, while, of course, endoscopy is the gold standard, I think we all recognize that we can't do endoscopy with great frequency in our patients. So we do need other methods to really be able to monitor, to apply this tight control paradigm that Marita has talked to us about. So when we think about what the limitations of endoscopy or colonoscopy performing procedures, there certainly can be some variability in scoring between observers. We talked about that. In ulcerative colitis, the Mayo is a little bit easier. The SESCD in Crohn's can have a little bit of variability. So from that standpoint, I actually try to scope my own patients so that I can really assess in the same fashion. Disease activity below the mucosal surface is not captured. So I'll show you some ways to do this, but Crohn's is obviously a transmural process, and you're not evaluating the bowel wall thickness with endoscopy. Certainly the utility can be limited by the patient themselves. Sometimes it's difficult to have a driver and come in and, you know, all of those aspects. The time off work, certainly it's time consuming, the bowel preparation. And delays can occur for many reasons that are quite patient-centric, whether that's difficulties in scheduling, cost, et cetera. So this speaks to the need for some sort of ability to assess the patient almost real-time in clinic without these difficulty factors, and that's where non-invasive monitoring comes in. So biomarkers are certainly one aspect of this, and we'll talk a little bit about fecal CalPro potentially as the most accurate biomarker. You know, when you think back to the CALM trial that Marita kind of set the stage for us with the role of tight control, they measured both CRP and fecal calprotectin, but in that trial, it was actually the CalPro that caused the kind of dose adjustment of medications with greater frequency than the CRP. So the CalPro really showed more usefulness in terms of that tight control adjustment. We also have cross-sectional imaging in the form of MRE, intestinal ultrasound, or certainly CTE as well, and capsule endoscopy, which obviously has been utilized for some time in terms of evaluating particularly proximal small bowel inflammation. So when we look at fecal calprotectin, this is a graph that demonstrates the correlation between fecal calpro and the CDEIS, which is just a different endoscopic scoring system for Crohn's disease. Believe it or not, it actually is even a little harder than the SES-CD, and so often the SES-CD is used a little bit more in clinical practice. But you can see that there is a nice correlation, particularly with colonic inflammation. When we look at overall Crohn's disease activity and this ROC curve, you're trying to understand, well, what is the best non-invasive marker? When you look at CRP or hemoglobin or platelets, we all recognize kind of the poor man's evaluation of inflammation. When the platelets go up, that can often be associated, or certainly calprotectin. And calprotectin actually, while of course not perfect, has the best kind of area under the curve in terms of assessing overall Crohn's disease activity. And when you think about fecal calpro, it actually often correlates not only with what's going on endoscopically, but also what's going on from a radiologic perspective. So this is just one example of the same patient, a 27-year-old woman who has colonic Crohn's disease, who also is symptomatic with abdominal pain. And as you can see, when you correlate, and this is the benchmarking effect that Marita was talking about, the fecal calpro is 436, which is elevated. We typically use a measure over, 150 to 200 as demonstrating active inflammation. On the MRE, you can see you also see considerable bowel wall thickness. You get access to that transmural inflammation. And then endoscopically, I would argue that these are the type of ulcerations you definitively would treat. This is, the deeper ulcerations, the serpiginous ulcerations associated with active Crohn's disease and not just, aphthous ulcerations. And so this allows you to have a full picture and a correlation. And what I like in this scenario is you now know what degree of inflammation is associated with that 436 calpro. And then you can obviously continue to monitor as you initiate treatment to ensure that this is improving. So this was a study that looked at various cutoffs of fecal calprotectin, particularly in the post-ileoconic resection state. This is postoperatively. And certainly a measure of fecal calprotectin less than 50 really is associated with zero endoscopic recurrence, whereas as you get higher than that, it correlates with having endoscopic recurrence. So this could be something that you could use early on. You know, in my practice, I actually tend to use a cutoff of more around 100, but I think that whether this is elevated helps to drive earlier looks from a colonoscopy perspective. We all recognize in the postoperative Crohn's disease patient, based on the POKER trial, we really should be looking at around 6 months postoperatively with colonoscopy to assess the anastomosis and then make modifications if necessary. In my very high-risk patients, I'll actually often check a 3-month CalPro, and if that is elevated, it actually will often make me move up that colonoscopy even more. And those are patients who've had multiple resections. They may be smokers. They may have failed multiple mechanisms. Those high-risk individuals, you may even want to assess earlier, but at a minimum at 6 months. And I have found this to be reliable in my practice. If this CalPro is up, it is a sign that there's some inflammation going on there. Although there are some factors that can be associated with an elevated CalPro that I just want to make sure we're all aware of. It's not perfect, and there are infectious etiologies that can also raise a CalPro. So certainly you would also want to check for things like C. difficile if the patient is symptomatic. If someone does have a neoplasm within the GI tract, that will increase calprotectin levels. What we see more often is NSAIDs. So patients on NSAIDs certainly have a higher calprotectin. Many of my patients, I try to teach them, don't use NSAIDs. You know, you never want to be on these if you have Crohn's disease in particular, unless, one-time dosing, those sorts of things I'm not as worried about. But I live in the South, and there are NSAIDs in everything. And so, I don't know if anyone has ever heard of goody powders, but goody powders are basically crushed NSAIDs to treat headaches. these are really prevalent, and people don't think about this as they're on NSAIDs.
It's a very Southern thing.
It's a very Southern thing. But also, many of the migraine preparations, you have to be careful because patients may not know that they're taking an NSAID that's in one of these multi-formulations. The other one that I have seen is PPI. And think about that. Many of our patients, particularly my patients with upper tract Crohn's disease, are on a PPI. There's good data that that should be the case, but it will actually increase CalPro in some individuals. Other inflammatory conditions certainly can increase CalPro as well. And so thinking through this differential, untreated food allergy even. So there can be false positives. And this is something that I've even had referrals to my practice where the person has been staged inside out and upside down and there's no inflammation, but the CalPro's up. So the test itself is not perfect, and in many instances I find that they're taking an intermittent NSAID or a PPI, and that may be the etiology. But generally, if the CalPro, if you have benchmarked it and you followed it over time and it's traditionally low and it goes up, that is quite valid. So just to circle back to why we're even talking about calprotectin is really the CALM trial that Marita introduced us to, that this tight control of monitoring biomarkers when symptoms aren't changed and being able to adjust medications actually will improve a very objective outcome. So in the CALM trial, the primary outcome was a CDEIS, one of the endoscopic scales, less than 4, and no deep ulcers. That's something we care about. That's something that we feel has affected disease progression. And as you can see here, with tight control, almost 50% of patients met this outcome as compared to only 30% in those patients whose drugs were only titrated based on symptoms. So really, more than half of patients in the tight control arm, while they did well, they didn't actually achieve that mucosal healing. So we still have ways to go, but certainly this will improve our ability to manage our patients. And now, because CALM was actually several years ago now, we actually have longer-term follow-up from this trial that demonstrates that those who achieve mucosal healing are much less likely to have disease progression. And in this study, that was defined, again, by things that we care about, including, endoscopic healing, no steroid treatment, developing fistulizing disease. Those aspects did not occur with as much frequency in those who actually achieved mucosal healing. So, and here are those data. More than a quarter of the patients who achieve mucosal healing still experience disease progression, meaning that we need to continue to monitor. And non-invasive monitoring may actually help us to achieve this tight control. And in CALM, that was just a fecal calprotectin. But now we do have a few other techniques available to us, and therefore I wanted to do a little primer on intestinal ultrasound and how this can be utilized in your patients. And intestinal ultrasound, while utilized in Europe for decades, has really only started to be utilized here in the U.S. over the past several years. Mount Sinai has obviously led this charge in helping us to utilize this in our practices here in the U.S. So just to walk you through quite quickly what this looks like, is in a point-of-care visit, when I'm seeing a patient in follow-up of their Crohn's disease, I can very quickly put a probe on and help me to understand factors that are associated with inflammation in various segments. You start, as you can see, in the left lower quadrant in the top picture, and you're able to then move in a stepwise fashion around the abdomen to visualize the entire colon and also the end part of the terminal ileum. Visualization is often best in the sigmoid colon on the left, which is great for ulcerative colitis, and in the terminal ileum on the right, which is great from a Crohn's disease perspective. And as you do this, you actually this is a schemata of kind of moving along the course of the bowel. And this allows you to actually get a pretty good understanding of distribution of inflammation throughout the colon and the ileum. The one area that is a little bit harder to visualize is the rectum. Obviously that area is retroperitoneal. It's very low, and you really just don't get as good penetration with the ultrasound. So from that standpoint, there are some limitations. But overall, this does give you a nice view into the colon and the N-terminal ileum in real time. On intestinal ultrasound, there are actually two major planes You can look longitudinally. That's kind of this longitudinal view, whereas cross-sectionally is your donut view. And both are useful in terms of helping to understand the degree of inflammation. The longitudinal view, you can actually even measure the length of segments, which can be quite helpful. So when we think about the bowel layers, this is what we're looking for. So, and if you look at the on the left, the cross-sectional donut first, you obviously have the lumen, and then you have this mucosal lumen interface. The layers we're actually measuring is actually that Oreo cookie, the black, white, black, of the deep mucosa, the submucosa, and the muscularis propria. And actually in my practice, what I've found, which you can't even see endoscopically, is that submucosa is very telling, that there are patients where the mucosa is actually relatively healed who still have a very inflamed and thickened submucosa. And so by enhancing my visualization, I've actually been able to optimize treatment to a greater extent, utilizing this in the terms of being able to view kind of the full bowel thickness. When we think about the features of active disease, again, on the left, you have a cross-sectional view. On the right, you have more of a longitudinal view. One of the things we're looking for is not only that thickness of the bowel, but whether there is hyperemia, which we can measure via Doppler. So this is really great, and it's really great with the patient sitting there right next to you as you do this. You put on a Doppler. That's all that red and blue that you see in the submucosa of that bowel. And that the patient real time can say, oh my goodness, I thought I'm starting to feel a little better, I still have a few symptoms, but look, this thickening, they see that bright red and blue Doppler in their face saying, you still have inflammation, and look at this bowel wall thickness. And I found it to be really helpful in conversations, and it helps patients to understand why we need to escalate therapy or why we need to make some of the changes we're making. On the right-hand side, in the longitudinal view, I actually have the bowel wall layers kind of delineated and colored out. But one of the things that can occur with inflammation is there are basically four things we're looking for. That bowel wall thickness that we spoke about, the hyperemia, that's the Doppler, the vascularity there that's increased. Those are both associated with inflammation. The other thing on the right is loss of bowel wall stratification, meaning that you don't see very crisp layers, and that is a sign that there is inflammation in the wall. And then the final sign is actually, if you'll note on both of these, it's very white around the bowel, and that's inflammatory fat around the actual bowel. And that inflammatory fat, believe it or not, will improve also as you treat inflammation. So those are the four signs of inflammation associated with intestinal ultrasound. So you can note that we're gaining a great deal of information here in adding 10 minutes to the visit in terms of really assessing those four factors that tell me in each segment whether or not there's inflammation there. So I think this is going to be a gimme, but I'm going to move into our first ARS question that I'll read, and then there will be some music playing where I'd encourage you to type in your answer. So what are the measures of inflammation on intestinal ultrasound? We have bowel wall thickness, bowel wall stratification, inflammatory fat stranding, bowel wall hyperemia, all of the above, or I don't know. So we'll give them a All right, great. Oh, perfect, 100%. Thank you for participating. And yes, all of these four factors are associated with inflammation. That said, I think probably the most important is bowel wall thickness. And this is just an example. I'll go ahead and use this marker here. But this white area here is kind of your lumen interface. It helps you in terms of anchoring. And then you can measure your bowel wall thickness here, always looking for that Oreo cookie, right? Black, white, black. And you can see how thickened this submucosa is here. This is an example of an image from the terminal ileum. And you can put a measurement on that, and you can see how thick that is. Anything over around 0.3 is actually significantly thickened and associated with inflammation. This is another measure that we spoke about. This is something called the modified Limburg score, which can be utilized it's kind of the degree of Doppler involvement in each segment that really correlates with the inflammation in the wall. So on the bottom left is zero. There's no Doppler pickup when you put it directly on the bowel segment. And the upper left, you have minimal. You see it kind of scant red and blue in the wall. On the right upper is a 2, which is where that signal is really there, but it's limited to just within the donut, within that submucosa. And then on the bottom right, you're just seeing signal not only within the bowel but outside the bowel. And this is very inflamed. When it's very inflamed, even that inflammatory fat will pick up the Doppler signal. And so this helps you, again, to have an objective measure as a yardstick if you're going to be following this patient forward in terms of that point of care assessment with intestinal ultrasound. And just to show you an example of the third aspect, the bowel wall stratification, before you saw in the picture that lumen interface was very crisp, very white. You could see that Oreo cookie incredibly well. Whereas here, it's very blurred. It almost isn't coming together correctly. It's very jagged. So this is an example of loss of preservation of the bowel wall layer stratification. And this is another factor that is in endoscopic or intestinal ultrasound scoring systems and is associated with inflammation. And then finally, this is an example of the inflammatory fat. Particularly when you look in the bottom right, your eye goes very quickly to that white around the bowel. Whereas in the upper left, you see in normal, we really don't see that. And so this is a very obvious marker that surrounding that bowel is even inflammatory fat, and it correlates with higher inflammation even within the bowel. So just to show you a few of these, what we call cine loops, so this is the terminal ileum. And as you can see, it's a cross-sectional view. You're seeing that donut. And within this, you actually see that submucosal layer, the white layer, which is, for those here in the room, this area here, is actually quite thickened, again, demonstrating inflammation here in the TI. So my next step as the operator looking at this would actually be to put a Doppler on that. And obviously, that submucosal layer can actually be thickened just with fibrosis, without active inflammation. But by putting this Doppler on, and this is a Limburg 2, you see the Doppler within the wall. We're not seeing it really outside in the inflammatory fat. You can really tell that this is active inflammation within this segment. And just to demonstrate with this loop one more time, one of the other things, you see the inflammatory fat, the white around there. But you can also track these loops and follow them and measure them. So you can actually even know that this is a 5-centimeter segment in the terminal ileum that has this thickening and increased vascularization. So this is an area that quite clearly, as I'm sitting there discussing with the patient, I'm going to be intervening. I'm going to be making a change in their medications. Even if they say, oh, I just have some mild symptoms, mild increased frequency, this is something I'd want to target from a disease modification perspective. And I don't necessarily need to expose them to radiation or bring them back for a colonoscopy in that scenario. So as we're thinking about IUS, who should this be performed on? The best performance, as I mentioned, I love the TI and the sigmoid. They're the best. The transverse colon and ascending colon can certainly be visualized as well. Most difficult, the rectum, I would argue. And this is really not a good test if you're trying to monitor upper tract Crohn's disease. Jejunum and duodenum, you're just not going to see well with intestinal ultrasound. So know which patients would be good candidates, and this is something that you may be able to utilize real time in your office. And I can certainly address for the U.S. audience other questions, surrounding utilization and reimbursement, but it's fine, and it is something that I think will be useful for you in your practice and is reimbursed. So when we think about accuracy of intestinal ultrasound, I already showed you some accuracy data comparing fecal calpro, another non-invasive marker, that it's actually quite accurate when compared to MRI and endoscopy. On the left, this is all the same patient. You see that hyperemia, thickening Doppler signal that we saw with the intestinal ultrasound. In the middle, on MRI, that terminal ileal segment, which is demonstrated right here. You can see the thickening in the wall and the distribution there. And then on, capsule, or this is actually endoscopy, you see the active inflammation as well. So again, a strong correlation, particularly in those areas where we know IUS is most useful. So what are the advantages of IUS for disease activity? It's non-invasive. That's great. I can do it right there in clinic. In my practice, I'm in North Carolina, and I really cater to about a 5-state area. We're one of the fewer IBD centers in the Southeast. So when someone's driving 5 hours just to see me, it's useful to have a measure that I can apply right there in clinic and help me with medical decision making. I showed you some data on accuracy, reproducible results. It's very well tolerated by patients. I found that my patients actually really dig this. They really like to see it. Well, they, of course, love it when it's not inflamed, but it helps them, I think, in understanding, you know, they like to be able to see themselves. You know, during colonoscopy, they're often asleep. Here, they're awake, they're looking real time, and it helps them to understand more about their disease. And there's no radiation exposure, which is really nice. I don't have to have that same patient come 3 hours early, go get a CT, et cetera, that I can look at the same day. This is a nice component. And I have utilized this in my pregnant patients. It can be a little bit more of a challenge. The gravid uterus can compress the sigmoid to a greater extent, so sometimes it actually gets displaced and is a little harder to locate. You can see the transverse colon really well in pregnancy, but the ileum is usually pretty well visualized, and so it becomes another way to monitor patients, obviously when we aren't going to use anything that causes radiation. So what are the limitations? It certainly needs specialized equipment. You can't. I would love it if you could just use, you know, a handheld tiny ultrasound machine. It does take a specialized machine with specialized probes to be able to see that bowel wall thickness. The image interpretation does require training, and that training is now available here in the U.S. There's certainly scheduling and cleaning protocols, and you can have challenges with image clarity, particularly in patients who have significant truncal obesity. You need to use a lower resolution probe to really penetrate, and so you just don't get quite the clarity. But that said, I would say still try, because I've actually been able to have some very good image resolution even in obese patients. And again, you cannot evaluate the proximal small bowel. So when we're doing this, certainly at diagnosis, when you're kind of initiating a treatment, that's a great time to do an intestinal ultrasound. You can assess response, and you can assess it at sooner intervals, actually. This bowel wall thickness actually improves fairly rapidly. There are even some studies that have been published looking at acute severe UC, where in a matter of days, you're really able to see those that have reduction in bowel wall thickness. So you could argue that you can assess response at 1 to 3 months, knowing it's not going to be perfect at that point, but you should start to be seeing some improvement in this bowel wall thickness. And then even in the remitted patient, thinking about IUS as a monitoring technique at 3 to 6 months, even when in remission, can certainly help to look and find pre-symptomatic changes in inflammation. And so these are, when we think about other modalities, MRE is certainly another good modality that doesn't have radiation associated with it. These are some images from MRE where you do see some of the same aspects that you can see with intestinal ultrasound in terms of the bowel wall thickening. The nice thing about MRE is I think you do probably get a better idea of kind of the length of involvement with MRE, and that can be certainly helpful. You can also look at mucosal healing via MRE, where you can see improvements in that bowel wall thickening and distribution on imaging. One of the things about MRE is it is actually quite good for the ileum. I find it to not be great in the proximal jejunum. Nothing is. And it's not potentially as accurate for the colon. For colonic disease, really, obviously, colonoscopy is our mainstay of therapy. But this is one study that looked at the accuracy by segments in the colon and found it to be reasonable, but not as good as what one sees in the small bowel. And so, particularly for severe lesions. So, when we think about what the advantages are, it can actually have the added advantage, which ultrasound does not have either, of not only identifying the mural, but extramural complications. Obviously, the imaging can pick up other aspects. There's no radiation exposure, and it can differentiate inflammation as compared to stricturing or penetrating disease. That is a little harder on intestinal ultrasound, although you can actually, with a stricture, you see the bowel very dilated above it on ultrasound, and then you can see things decompressed. It's just not, it's a little bit harder to see exactly where you are on intestinal ultrasound, where the MRE obviously gives you a much better roadmap. And actually, depending on your surgeon's comfort, they may want cross-sectional imaging if someone is going to surgery as to how comfortable they are with IUS findings. It is useful for treatment and intervention planning. There are some barriers to MRE. This is very costly, as many of us know, and that is something that, for many of my patients, is rate-limiting to have the copay associated with an MRE. Again, that colonic disease, not quite as accurate. Time requirement, this takes a while. And patients can get claustrophobic in the scanner. In the MRE, it is a little bit harder, I would argue, to differentiate inflammation from fibrosis when you see that thickening. You can certainly see inflammatory fat and other signs that there's likely inflammation, but I do like the Doppler aspect of IUS, which I think is a very real-time way to assess for true inflammation. Video capsule certainly can be important in patients with Crohn's disease. It can be used both in surveillance and in diagnosis initially. It's particularly beneficial in patients with proximal small bowel disease and a normal ileocolonoscopy. This is one of the few, I think, very accurate ways of assessing for jejunal inflammation. There certainly is one risk that we counsel patients about, and that's the risk of capsule retention. So generally in my practice, I ensure that a patient with Crohn's who's swallowing a capsule has either had some form of cross-sectional imaging where I have assessed for a stricture or has had a patency capsule, just to be certain that you're not stuck with a capsule that then needs to be addressed. Sometimes you can go in and remove them endoscopically, but in some instances it even requires surgery for removal. And capsule endoscopy can support a Crohn's diagnosis in a patient with normal upper and lower endoscopy studies. And so there's literature evidence that shows that this is the case. So, in summary, fecal calprotectin, I would argue, use this over CRP in terms of biomarker monitoring and in your tight control paradigm for your patients. In the CALM study, this was the factor that was most associated with need for adjustment. Intestinal ultrasound can be utilized in point-of-care assessments in patients with Crohn's disease. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about it in the Q&A session, but also if you're interested, for those of you who are here in person at ACG, in the hands-on area of the exhibit hall this afternoon, there's actually going to be a session. Several of us will have the machines there, and people can kind of do a hands-on assessment of intestinal ultrasound. I believe that starts at 3:45 this afternoon in the hands-on exhibit hall, so come check it out. And then certainly non-invasive monitoring. I hope I've convinced you this needs to happen. Whether it's CalPro or another measure, this is really important now in terms of the management of Crohn's disease. And that whatever technique you're using, CalPro, IUS, MRE, capsule, you're going to want to come up with a strategy to help to ensure your patients are not only improving symptomatically, but also improving from a biomarker and biologic inflammation perspective. And so with that, I will turn it back over to Bruce.
Wonderful. Thank you, Millie. A great talk. Really a tour de force. Really you outlined the case for intestinal ultrasound as well as the other non-invasive strategies. And I wonder, you know, for the people in the room, how many of you have incorporated one or more of these non-invasive strategies into your practice? Just raise your hand if you're doing it. Looks like
a few,
yeah. But not everyone. So I think it's worth discussing sort of the practicalities of what we actually do. Not everyone has ultrasound.
Correct.
Maybe the first thing to talk about a little bit more is, what is the training like? You've trained and you do it now.
I went and visited Sinai, and that was great. They do a wonderful job. So the training has become more readily accessible here in the U.S. It consists of three modules, and there's a governing organization called IBUS, the International Bowel Ultrasound Group, that helps with certification. But there's now a very active group called IUSCAN, which is the U.S. Version of this. And within these modules, the first, you do some online work, looking at images like I just showed you, helping you to kind of set your eye and understand bowel wall thickness. You do a in-person kind of module one course with expert faculty. Then module two is actually just practical experience where you go to a center that uses intestinal ultrasound, kind of have a mentored experience. It's usually done over about 2 weeks. It can be split up. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be contiguous. And then module three is actually just a test that is a certification. And that in the past had been done actually at DDW in the spring and also at ECHO over in Europe. But I think that there's some push to move that even to online to help with accessibility. And so I actually was able to complete this process over about a six-month period where I did the module one, spent some time visiting in terms of sites that do intestinal ultrasound. Now, when I was trained, there were only three sites in the country that were doing this, so that made it a little bit harder. But now there are many more sites across the U.S. from the West Coast to the East Coast that are using intestinal ultrasound that could be an opportunity for some of that hands-on experience. Really now in my practice, I know at Sinai Bruce can explain how they do it, but we don't have just an ultrasound clinic where referrals come in just to get an ultrasound. Myself and one other provider at UNC are certified, and we're using it much more just point of care, as I described, where in my own patients, when they're coming in, I actually will utilize intestinal ultrasound more in this tight control paradigm. I think that there are other models where you can actually even refer patients for intestinal ultrasounds for assessment, and that's great. And I think from a pediatrics perspective, that's huge, because in pediatrics particularly, they really want to avoid interventional procedures or trying to have to sedate a kid to put them in an MRI machine. You know, this is a very favorable way to assess from a pediatrics perspective. So it is much more accessible. The machine itself can be somewhat expensive at baseline, but the reimbursement is reasonable. You're billing for a limited abdominal ultrasound in the U.S. For those internationally, this may not be as applicable, but it's 0.7 RVUs, and then there is a facility fee charged if you're a hospital-based clinic. But in reality, you're doing it while you're talking to the patient and seeing them. So it doesn't – I'm often kind of capturing the history while I'm doing this. So it doesn't add a great deal of additional time. Really, as you become more facile with it, you know, maybe 5 minutes or so if you combine, you know, some of the other aspects of the visit. And so so I think that hopefully this will have more traction, you know, here in the U.S., and I would encourage you to look into it. While not a huge money maker, it certainly is something that will pay for itself and will certainly help you in terms of management of your patients. And Bruce, I know your program is one of the old, you were the first program here in the U.S., and so I'm sure you have a great deal of experience.
Well, I personally do not. I'm an old dog who hasn't yet learned how to do this new technique. I don't rule out the possibility that I'll invest the time to do it. And the truth is, not all of us at Mount Sinai do it. There are a cadre of us who do it, some of whom are sort of minute men and women who can be pulled into a room if we have a question. So it isn't every patient that we're using, you know, every visit IUS, as you could do with your patients. Obviously, the ones who are trained to do that, they do that routinely. But for those of us who haven't trained, it's a sporadic thing when we have a question. And I agree, it's a wonderful tool to draw the patient into their own care, in a way, show them what's going on, depict it right in front of them, rather than they have a scan and an MRI scanner, and then they come back a few weeks later and you sort of talk about it. You might show them an image, but they don't really understand it. It's a little bit harder to grasp. So I think it can be very useful. I think, you know, University of Chicago is another center. I don't know, are you trained in IUS?
So currently advanced practice providers are not trained through IBIS, but there's work being done to allow that to happen. But we have a lot of providers at U of C that are trained. So we do kind of that point of care model that you had mentioned, but also ultrasound clinics, which allow us to kind of keep that tight control strategy through kind of a team-based approach.
So what about all the other strategies that we talked about, the biomarkers, MRE, capsule endoscopy? I mean, what I could ask you, Marita, is sort of how do you put it all together? What take us through a journey with a patient. They're newly diagnosed, and then you're monitoring the Crohn's patient. Your patient, what do you do since you don't do IUS, although it's available to you? How do you put those components together?
Yeah, so certainly the first thing I look at is disease distribution. So if I've got a patient, like you said, with very proximal small bowel disease, that's a patient I would love cross-sectional imaging in, or perhaps a capsule if they don't have any stricturing behavior. But looking really with the patient of kind of laying out a timeline of, we're starting this new medication, I expect that at this point that you'll start to feel a response to the therapy that I'm giving you, even if you don't feel perfect yet. But then we're looking as well with calprotectin or CRP, or, you know, as you mentioned, you know, some of the poor man's assessments of mm-hmm. reactive thrombocytopenia is improving and all of that. And then kind of getting them through that journey to, ideally, you know, endoscopic healing or radiographic healing that we've gotten them through with their therapy. And at any point, if we're not meeting those marks, that we're pivoting and that we're optimizing our plan and just staying dynamic to the patient's current inflammatory burden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we do the same thing. I mean, gone are the days, I think since STRIDE we realized, you know, gone are the days where we simply ask a patient if they feel better, that, and that's all that we do, and tell them, come back if you if you're feeling
right.
poorly. That
right. yeah.
that was the old-fashioned way of doing things when I was training, but we learned the outcomes just weren't good if you did that.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that you shouldn't also be asking the patient
yeah,
how they
course.
Feel, of course, and maybe we'll talk about that in a little bit later for the Q&A session, because there are some questions about that. But we need objective ways mm-hmm. of monitoring patients. So now you've shown the different ways that we can do that, and the biomarkers are sort of interim things that we can do along the way. We can do them relatively frequently. IUS, the barriers are low. We can do that as often as we can get the patient in. And in fact, there are even studies now where patients are provided with probes at home and instructed, hold the probe here or there and send in acquired images. It's not out of the realm of possibility for home monitoring even.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see that incorporated more and more. I think one thing that we haven't seen very much incorporated into adult practice in the United States anyhow is capsule endoscopy. And mm-hmm. I sometimes wonder why that is, because it's relatively non-invasive.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to certain centers in Israel, they do this very routinely. Of course, they were the innovators
right.
of the technology, so great believers. But they use it, and they've demonstrated the ability. So how do you incorporate capsule endoscopy? You mentioned the barriers, which are
right.
the risk of impaction in a stricture
yes.
in a patient with Crohn's.
Well, and frankly, and I think likely folks in the room know this, they still need to do a bowel prep with a capsule endoscopy as
yeah.
well. So we usually do a half bowel prep with capsule endoscopy. It really helps you to see the mucosal lining to a greater extent. So capsule is not a everyone in my practice needs a capsule type phenomenon for me. Where I utilize capsule is when I have something out of the ordinary of what I would expect. So someone who, you know, their colon is healed, but they continue to require iron infusions for iron deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that, am I missing something from the mucosal side? I think that all of my patients at some point get some form of cross-sectional imaging in terms of an enterography exam, whether it's a CTE or an MRE. But I would encourage you to remember that mucosal inflammation, particularly in the proximal small bowel, can be missed on MRE. And so for those scenarios where I am concerned that there may still be active inflammation, that's where I use the capsule. And sometimes you really can pick up you know, proximal inflammation that you didn't realize was there. And so that's my mainstay of utilization of capsule, just because we have other forms of assessment that I think give us a good idea of what is going on. When you have a very normal CalPro, you know, you've had cross-sectional imaging that looks good, colon and endoscopy and colonoscopy, you know, show endoscopic response or endoscopic remission. I'm very comfortable in that scenario. It's when something is outside of the ordinary.
I think what you're highlighting is to be aware of the blind spots of
right.
each of our tests that we're using. You know, for IUS, rectum is not going to
nope.
be,
yeah.
you know, that's one of the blind spots. You know, for cross-sectional imaging, you know, proximal bowel,
yeah.
a blind spot. So each of these things have pros and cons. We have to learn how to pick and choose
mm-hmm.
Our tools for the right patient in the right scenario. So I think that's really, this is such an important thing that we need to do for our patients with IBD in general, not just Crohn's disease, and it is a wave that we're going to see of intestinal ultrasound that's going to sweep this country, is already sweeping the country, and I think eventually all practices will be doing this. It's been commonplace in certain countries in Europe mm-hmm. for a long time, and we're just a little bit late to the show.
True. And one of the things that I do in one of the hats I wear is I'm a trialist. Not as much of a trialist as Bruce, but I am a trialist. And some of the newer trials are even having ultrasound arms now, which is great. So that will actually give us more data on if you're doing serial ultrasounds in a very controlled fashion in a clinical trial for approval of an agent, you actually really are going to know time to response and various other factors that one can then extrapolate to clinical practice. And so I'm actually really glad that this is being incorporated into the clinical trial structure as well, because I think it'll give us very readily available data that we can then utilize in practice.
Yeah, one of the pieces of information that we're lacking is, of course, along the way, we've talked about the value of endoscopic improvement or healing. We've talked about radiographic, you know, imaging improvement or healing. And we have abundant data from observational studies that patients who achieve these outcomes and deeper levels of these outcomes actually do better. Mm-hmm. But these are associative studies.
Right.
It's a little bit different from saying if you work hard to drive a patient to that state, then the ultimate long-term outcomes
very
are
true.
Better. And so there are very important studies now that are actually trying to identify whether is it enough to look at endoscopic healing, or do you have to go to histology? Is it enough to go for endoscopic healing, or do you have to do transmural healing as well, and seeing if you actually change the treatment to achieve that goal, that the ultimate outcomes are better. So we'll have to wait for those studies.
Yes.
But that is an entree to my last talk here, which is about histopathologic remission in Crohn's disease. And I'll start by saying this is really kind of avant-garde at this mm-hmm. moment. We talk about histopathologic remission quite a bit in ulcerative colitis, and we do know that patients who do better if they have achieved that histopathologic remission in UC. And I'll show you there is some evidence of that in Crohn's disease, but we're much farther behind when we're talking about Crohn's disease in this regard. So we can think of deeper and deeper levels of achieving remission in inflammatory bowel disease. Clinical remission would be the patient feels perfect. They feel like they did before they ever had the disease, ideally. No residual symptoms, and that certainly should be a goal. It's not attainable for everyone. Of course, endoscopic outcomes are a compelling part of the approval of every drug and part of what we all do in clinical practice. Mostly we're talking about white light endoscopy. There are techniques like chromoendoscopy that we throw in for detection of dysplasia, not so much disease activity. And there are even fancy endoscopic techniques to look at endomicroscopy, which sort of hints at what we might be doing with histologic remission, which is really we're going to biopsy, and the pathologist is going to tell us if the disease is truly quiet or not. And finally, we could get to things that are even deeper, at a deeper level, because we know that the barrier function, for example, is deficient in patients with Crohn's disease. In fact, that probably occurs before the disease actually flares. So it's even a preclinical state. So ideally, healing the barrier as well. Obviously, when you have ulcers, the barrier is disrupted. But even when there's an attacked appearing mucosa, there can be a defect in the barrier. There could also be various molecular perturbations that we might detect on maybe a blood marker, but that's really out there. We don't have anything like that at this point. So I do have a question for you, which is, if you can respond, which of the following parameters can be measured by histopathologic evaluation in Crohn's disease? Is it A, inflammatory activity, B, disease distribution, C, fistula formation, D, duration of disease, or E, I don't know.
So something strange in your neighborhood. Who you gonna call?
So I think most of you have correctly honed in on inflammatory activity. That is something that we can determine in Crohn's disease histology, just like we can in ulcerative colitis, even though it's less well-defined. I'll give you partial credit for disease distribution because, as I'll show you, some of the indices being looked at in IBD and in Crohn's disease are trying to get at that notion of disease distribution too. I don't think we could do fistula formation because that's kind of a macroscopic feature. Duration of disease, we might get hints of that in terms of chronicity, so I'll give you maybe partial credit for that. If you don't know, you don't know. What can you do? So I want to start by talking where this all starts, which is in the ulcerative colitis instruments that we do have. And the classic one, maybe the oldest one, and the one widely used in clinical trials in ulcerative colitis is the Gabeau's score. The Gabeau's score is actually a grading system. It wasn't really intended quite as a scoring system. And on the left-hand side, you can see different levels of grading, starting with architectural changes with no abnormality or various degrees of abnormality. There is a grade that is one level higher, which is a chronic inflammatory infiltrate. So these are mononuclear cells. Another level is the presence of polymorphonucleocytes, including eosinophils for 2A or for 2B neutrophils, to different degrees, or mild, moderate, and marked increase. On the right-hand side, you can see the Robarts histologic index. And this was an attempt really to create a scoring system out of what was just a gradation system of Gabeau's and to validate it and to look for thresholds for histologic response or remission, and these have been defined over time. And you can see on the right-hand side different assignments of scores that correlate with the different levels of the Gabeau's score on the left-hand side. It's a little bit complicated, and I'll have to admit that even at Mount Sinai, we do not get a Gabeau's score back
UC.
We don't get an RHI back. But we do get statements about neutrophils, and that's where I'm going to hone in as being maybe the most important factor. And that's what you see here. The next level, when we get to start talking about grade 3 in the Gabeau's score, less than 5% of crypts involved, that's a level 3.1 in the Gabeau's score, is a kind of a threshold for histologic remission in UC. And on the Robarts Histologic Index, you can see different levels there. Then we get to bigger and bigger things like crypt destruction. You see that, and that's where the neutrophils are just eating away at the crypt, and erosions and ulcerations, you know, which presumably you're also going to see endoscopically. And I really think of endoscopic imaging and histologic as kind of the macro and the micro. It's the wide view and the very narrow view. And that is actually one of the dilemmas for Crohn's disease, because if you think about it, UC tends to be a continuous disease, relatively monotonous in how it involves the segments of the large bowel that involves. But in Crohn's disease, we often have this patchiness of disease. So one of the dilemmas is, how do we actually sample accurately? Do we go to the worst area? Do we go to the most average area? How do we make sure that we've sampled across all the different segments? And can we even get to the small bowel adequately to sample? So there are a number of issues. But I think if you take away anything from the Gabeau's score and the RHI and how we would apply it to Crohn's disease, it's about the neutrophils. It's about erosion and ulceration primarily. And that's what you can look for in your pathology reports, even if you don't have a scoring system. Mm-hmm. There is a simpler score that's used in UC. It's the Nancy Index. You can see it only has four levels, five, I guess, if you include zero. And here, just as I said, it's really about the not the chronic inflammation so much, but the active inflammation, the neutrophils, and then the destruction of the mucosa. And you see those different descriptions here. But again, even though this is very simple and intended for clinical practice, I don't know of many centers where we're actually getting a report of a Nancy index back. So what proof is there that histologic healing is associated with better long-term outcomes, not in UC, which, you know, there is abundant evidence for, but in Crohn's disease? There's not a huge amount of evidence, but there are a few studies. The top one is by Brennan. It's a retrospective cohort study. That's where most of the data is coming from. You can see it's not an enormous study, 62 patients followed for at least 6 months, and then a total of 103 who had elective colonoscopies during clinical remission. Endoscopic activity and active disease was recorded, and then some sort of semi-quantitative score for histologic characteristics. And generally, the outcome was that at 12 months, the rate of relapse was 25.5% in the patients who did have histologic activity, compared with only 2.4% of the patients without histologic activity at baseline. And so the presence of histologic activity was associated with a higher rate of flare, significantly so. Again, we don't know much about kind of their sampling protocol. This was retrospective. There may not have been a protocol of where exactly do you get the biopsies. And then I'll show you actually a graphic depiction of the results from Christensen, another retrospective study, a little over 100 patients followed for, on average, 21 months. 63% of these patients had endoscopic remission, 55% achieved histologic remission, and clinical remission occurred in 42% of patients. And as I'm going to show you, histologic healing was associated with a decreased risk of complicated or clinical relapse or more complicated disease. And you see this here, the ones who on the left-hand side were looking at the histologic remission versus activity. Remission is the solid line. And you can see the survival curve is on the top, and there are lower rates of clinical relapse. This is in ileal Crohn's disease. On the right is endoscopic remission or activity. Again, you do see an impact there. So both of these things are impactful, endoscopy and histology, in the outcomes in Crohn's disease. Again, these studies like this don't answer the question whether driving harder with your therapy is going to actually do better for the patient, but this does show that the patient who does achieve it will do better. So, you know, we're borrowing things from ulcerative colitis, but what are people doing to actually create indices to measure histology in Crohn's disease? One of the ones that has been used is the GHAS, the Global Histologic Disease Activity Score. You can see it incorporates a lot of the same concepts that are used in ulcerative colitis. The architectural changes, which are really chronic changes. Epithelial damage, that's important. The mononuclear cells, that's chronicity. The polymorphonuclear cells in the lamina propria, that's activity of the disease and in the epithelium for sure. So there are different levels of this. This has been applied in just a handful of clinical trials, but mostly not used. And then this is an interesting one. It's the components of the IBD. It's the IBD DCA score. DCA stands for distribution, chronicity, and activity. That's why I was willing to give you partial credit for distribution. And this would apply to both Crohn's and UC. It's an attempt to create a scoring system for both conditions. Distribution is normal or less than 50% of the tissue samples from the same biopsy site or more than that in the same biopsy site. Chronic features, crypt distortion or mild lymphoplasmacytosis, again, that's chronicity, or marked basal plasmacytosis. So those are the chronicity features, and then the activity features are what you see there, culminating in crypt abscesses, erosions, and ulcers. So an example of this, how would you actually apply this in clinical practice or the real world? The distribution is the overall affected tissue in scanning magnification, 2.5 to 4 times. This is all for your histopathologist, your pathologist to do. So, for example, if you have 4 biopsies and half of them are affected by inflammatory architectural changes, more than 50%, that's a D2. Chronicity is looking for those architectural distortion and band-like lymphoplasmacytosis, C2, and activity is what you see below. So, you know, it doesn't seem like a terribly complicated or difficult system. On the other hand, we don't know the implications for long-term outcomes, We don't have thresholds yet defined for we need this score to achieve to know that a patient is going to do better. So I think this is very forward-looking, but at the moment, this is just conceptual in my view. So in summary, there are several histopathologic indices that exist for scoring disease activity in Crohn's. Mostly we're just borrowing from UC. And several important long-term outcomes have been associated with histologic healing in Crohn's disease, but there's so much more work to be done here. So I want to ask the faculty, you know, what is the state of incorporating histopathologic activity measures in patients with Crohn's disease in your practice? Maybe the first thing to ask you is, do all of your practitioners at University of Chicago, are they routinely biopsying their Crohn's patients, and are they doing it for all the segments, involved segments? Is there even a protocol?
Yeah, so they're definitely biopsying segments of active disease, but in terms of protocols of areas of non-active disease, it's a little bit less clear. So this is something that I kind of struggle with when the patient will come back in, you know, 2 weeks after their scope to talk about therapy.
Did I do well? Didn't I do well?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So looking at, you know, maybe macroscopically things look good, but we've got some hint of disease activity microscopically and how aggressive we want to be in terms of, like you said, kind of driving that therapy and to what benefit.
Yeah. Millie at UNC, is there a protocol?
There's not a protocol. I actually, you know, if the ileum looks pristine, I don't biopsy it.
Because you don't know how to act.
I wouldn't
upon
know.
It
I don't do a test unless I know what I am going, how I'm going to change my practice based on that.
I like that philosophy.
And
too.
If I, for example, and I think Bruce has pointed that we don't know that if someone is on whatever therapy you want to choose, that if they have a little bit of histologic activity, if I adjust the dosing and increase the frequency, that I'm necessarily going to change their outcomes. And so I biopsy from a colonic standpoint, obviously, from a dysplasia perspective, and so I often will be taking colonic biopsies in a patient with inflammatory bowel disease, whether it be colonic or ulcerative colitis. But I have not yet incorporated, for example, ileal biopsies into my practice. I don't drive to histologic healing. If histologic healing is there, it is a very good prognosis for my patients. And actually, I would argue that based off of the British guidelines for surveillance, if you have a patient with colonic disease and you've actually reached histologic healing, I actually am able to lengthen their interval for surveillance where I'm not doing it as frequently. So that's something I'd change. And so that's why I do biopsy the colon, because I feel like it allows me to bring them back less frequently for surveillance colonoscopy.
For a patient who has at least one-third of their
colon involved. Remember, that's the minimum. You have to have at least a third of your colon involved to be in a surveillance protocol.
Right. And I would say, you know, Mount Sinai is a big place, and we don't all practice homogeneously. And I think people do as they will. Some people will take routine biopsies in the ileum and in other places in the colon just to see. And I guess they're using it prognostically, not necessarily to change therapy. They can tell the patient something good if they see absolute normality. But I think it's not, it isn't uniform that people will do that. Some do and some don't. So I want to wrap up this section before we go to question and answer and tell you, hopefully, that we've achieved our SMART goals, which mean specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely, and we hope you found all of this very relevant and timely, especially, that you can consider disease severity in a patient's overall disease course when making choices regarding treatment selection, utilize advanced therapies in patients with Crohn's disease without first requiring failure or tolerance of conventional therapies, and finally incorporate non-invasive monitoring strategies into the routine care of patients with Crohn's disease. So I really hope that you're going to integrate some of these concepts into your practice, and I do want to thank Millie and Marita for excellent presentations and for your attention. And now we have time just a little bit for some questions and answers, and quite a few have come in here. And maybe one that we can talk about is PROs that are important to us in Crohn's disease. So Marita first, there are some classic PROs and maybe what we call non-classic. What do you like to attain from a patient?
So typically when I'm talking with patients about their bowel-specific symptoms, a lot of it surrounds frequency, urgency, and abdominal pain for these patients, because those are the things that are keeping patients out of, you know, the things they want to be doing and in our office. So it's the things that are really impacting quality of life that I am focusing on primarily and kind of matching those up with those objective markers that we had mentioned.
I agree. Obviously, the PRO2 for Crohn's disease has to do with bowel frequency and abdominal pain. But I would argue that urgency, while we think of it as more something associated with ulcerative colitis because of rectal involvement, it's actually quite prevalent in Crohn's disease and can dramatically affect our patients. You know, up to 80% of patients, even with Crohn's, can have urgency. So I would encourage you to ask about that. The other one that is big for my patients that I ask about is fatigue. You know, fatigue, I would say over half of patients, you know, actually have some form of fatigue. And, you know, while there, in many instances we can really help with that, you know, obviously I check vitamin levels, I check iron levels, I maximize those, make sure that the subclinical inflammation is controlled. You know, in some instances it's sleep that's affecting that, and so really asking about sleep can be helpful. And in some instances it's mood, and treating underlying mood disorders can also be dramatically helpful from a fatigue perspective. So I think thinking about the whole patient, and if we don't ask, they may not let us know. And so, you know, really being thoughtful about what those PROs are that are abnormal, that are most prevalent in the population, helps you to be able to address them for your patients.
Yeah, we actually screen for mood disorders as the patients are coming through the door, just a very short survey, and that's flagged to us. So I think that is very important. I call fatigue the most common extraintestinal manifestation of IBD, but it's a protean symptom and has so many different causes. This is a great question, I think, because we have Marita here, and this person says, how are you using NPs in your practice? And I would rephrase and say, how are we working with APPs in your practice? So how do you work with the physicians in the practice, Marita?
So I think this is a hot topic kind of nationally right now, and certainly incorporating an advanced practice provider into a large clinical practice with a lot of complex IBD patients can feel complex, especially for those who haven't collaborated with advanced practice providers in the past. But typically at University of Chicago, we really are optimizing our abilities to work to the top of our licensure. So I see patients completely autonomously that perhaps are new patients, perhaps are return patients of the really esteemed physician colleagues that I have. But oftentimes I'm also seeing patients in that really critical window post hospital discharge or post-surgery where we're optimizing, you know, salvage therapies for patients. So really, you know, we're seeing patients to the highest level of acuity, but really working in that team multidisciplinary model where we're able to really hone in on different things at each visit and making sure that, you know, whether I'm seeing the patient or my physician colleague is seeing the patient, that we're really looking comprehensively and kind of alternating volleying back and forth between each other for those return visits. That way the patient has a handle on everyone on the team, so no matter who's calling them, they're familiar with, you know, the voice on the phone.
Yeah, I think we work in very much the same way, and really the team aspect of IBD care is what is coming to the fore, and I know it's harder to do in private practice, but private practices are getting bigger and bigger and more specialized, and certainly are incorporating the expertise of APPs into their IBD team as well. We're also fortunate to have a pharmacist, social worker, lots of other things, but we're a gigantic center. So APPs are at the center of it all. Well, I can't believe how quickly the time has flown here. It really has been a pleasure, and I want to just remind you that if you have colleagues who missed today's live program, this activity will be available on the Gastroenterology Hub on CME Outfitters' website, which also has additional resources for clinicians and patients. And I'd like to thank Millie and Marita for joining me today for this great opportunity to learn together and to improve our care of patients with Crohn's disease. And I also want to thank CME Outfitters for their assistance in developing today's terrific program, and to all of you for coming out this morning, or if you're out there watching us on the web, for joining us virtually as well. So just one last thing, which is to claim credit, CME or CE credit for today's program, complete the post-test evaluation and the evaluation. Thank you again to the faculty for joining me, and thank all of you, and have a wonderful meeting here at ACG. Thanks so much. Okay.